is going to teach us some big things as we wrap it up. The loose ends get tied together here in this story, and it's so beautiful. So Ruth, as you know, she's got come with Naomi. They are both widows. Naomi is her mother-in-law. They're both widows. They've left Moab, and they've turned back toward Naomi's hometown, which is Bethlehem. And Bethlehem is known as the house of bread. Naomi had left because of famine, and now she's turned back to the house of bread. And Ruth refuses to let her go alone, even though Naomi says, don't do it, don't do it. I mean, Ruth is going to be a foreigner there. When she gets there, she is truly the least of the least. She is poor. She's a widow. She's a foreigner. She's got no family, no name, no man to take care of her, no man to kind of cover her and call her his family. So they are there. She decides she's going to glean in the field. She's going to follow behind the harvesters just as a scavenger, and she's going to pick up the leftovers so she and Naomi can survive. It's a dangerous job, but Ruth steps into it, and then when she is there, she meets Boaz, who the writer will tell us time and time and time again is a relative of Naomi. It's real important to the writer that we understand that Boaz is related to Naomi. Boaz is near to their problem. And so Naomi, in chapter 3, last week Pastor Steve Mickel talked about this, Naomi hatches a plan. And she decides to have Ruth get gussied up and go to the threshing room floor. Do people still say gussied? Did I just expose? Oh, Eli, come on, man. He's like, nope. So she gets gussied up and goes to the threshing room floor, and she proposes to Boaz. She says, put your garment over me. She's saying, and Naomi didn't tell her to do this. She just decides this is the right thing at the right time. I'm going to go for broke and say, will you go ahead and marry me? I want to be a part of your family. And so Boaz agrees, but he says, there is someone closer to you than I am. There's a nearer redeemer than me. And so you go home and you wait. I'm going to take care of it tomorrow. So chapter 3 ends that way. And Naomi hears that Boaz is going to step up into this role as redeemer. And she says to Ruth, wait, my daughter, until you find out how things go, for he will not rest unless he has resolved the matter today. There is something in Naomi's heart that knows Boaz is dead set on doing the right thing and doing it quickly. In the chapter before, Boaz mentions that Ruth is such a noble woman because she could have gone after a man much younger. Some of the scholars I read think there might have been a 40-year age gap here. I know, it's a lot. But I think there are hints in this story that there is true affection between these two people. In my experience, the only thing that drives someone to solve a matter this important, this quickly, is love or hate. And I don't think he hates her. So I think he's moving on this. I think there are hints that this isn't just a marriage of convenience. Our text here bears the slightest tinge of fairy tale. Crazy. And it doesn't really matter to the story whether or not that's true, but it does matter as we start to look at Boaz as a type of our Redeemer who comes to redeem us, not to fulfill a contract, not to check a box, not even to rescue us from gathering in a field, but because he loves us. He comes to redeem us because he loves us. And I love that idea in this story. So I'm going to go ahead and believe it. And you can believe whatever you want. If you're a cynic, Eli, you can believe it. So this brings us to the end of the story. Meanwhile, Boaz went to the gate and sat down there. Soon the kinsman redeemer of whom he had spoken came along. And Boaz said, come over here, my friend, and sit down. So he went over and sat down. Then Boaz took 10 of the elders of the city and said, sit here. And they did so. So this verse starts with meanwhile. Remember a couple of weeks ago I talked to you about always pay attention in the Bible when you see a word that marks a time or a situation. Meanwhile is a word like that. When the Bible tells you meanwhile, you want to ask, what's going on? Who's in the meanwhile? And what it's talking about here is Ruth is waiting. Naomi's just said, wait, Boaz is gonna resolve this. And so Ruth now is waiting for a redeemer. She is waiting to see if she's going to be saved or not. And I think like everyone has a meanwhile season. Times when we're just waiting to see what comes next. How might God come through? And I think what Ruth would want us to know today is that there is often many things happening in the meanwhiles of your life. God is at work in the meanwhile. He's at work behind the scenes in ways you can't see, in ways you couldn't possibly imagine. God is at work there. He is at work building something, and he is doing something you can't see in the situation, and more importantly, he's doing something in you, in the waiting. So the gate here is a logical place for Boaz to go to wait for someone to pass by. By intentional design, a walled city has very few entrances and exits. This town, so the gate is a great place to be if you want to run into somebody, but it's also the place where the elders of the town could be found holding court, sharing news, gossiping, executing contracts, agreeing on things. It's just a really populated place. So what's about to happen here between them is a little bit complex, and it doesn't bear a lot of weight on our story, except I want you to understand where it comes from. They're doing this because it's in the law given to Moses. This is the law for Israelites, and so I'm going to read to you a little bit of that out of Deuteronomy 25. When brothers live together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the deceased shall not be married outside the family to a strange man. Her husband's brother shall go to her and take her to himself as wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. It shall be that the firstborn whom she bears shall assume the name of his dead brother, so that his name will not be blotted out from Israel. So that's the law. That's what's happening around this. The writer has been setting us up since chapter 2 that Boaz is a kinsman redeemer of Naomi. Three times in one chapter, he tells us. And now, out of nowhere, we're introduced to this whole new character. As soon as Ruth shows up at Boaz's place, Boaz is like, hey, there's another guy. There's somebody else. And we don't know this guy. And for now, we're just going to call him the man with no name. He's a pretty big deal in the story. Because Boaz doesn't actually, the writer doesn't actually name him, but he's a big deal. And his lineage matters. I promise you, the writer knows his name. The writer knows who this is, but he has decided on purpose not to tell us. He's given him a little thing. There's a device in the Hebrew language. In the translation, Boaz calls this guy my friend. But in the actual language, it's this little phrase that is poloni almoni, which is just fun to say. It's poloni almoni. And it means hidden, mysterious, silent, or mute. So poloni almoni is a way to deliberately obscure the identity of someone. The writers are essentially saying this guy's name is nobody. They didn't forget it. They don't want us to know his name. Why would they care? Let's keep reading. Then he said to the guardian redeemer, Naomi, who has come back from Moab, is selling the piece of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. I thought I should bring the matter to your attention and suggest that you buy it in the presence of these seated here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, do so. But if you will not, tell me so I will know. For no one has the right to it except you, and I am next in line. I will redeem it, he said. I will redeem it, nobody said, is how that goes. So first, Boaz offers this guy first shot at this land, and the guy jumps at it. He wants the land, and it's interesting that Boaz says Naomi is selling the land, because no, she isn't. I mean, because if that's true, why didn't she sell it before when we said she was destitute? She's not selling the land. She has no right to sell the land. She is only attached to it through her dead husband. And so she wants someone to redeem it and redeem her. But Naomi has no power in the game. And yet Boaz keeps putting Naomi's name out in the middle of this. So this is the part where you start to think, oh no, our leading lady and leading man are not going to end up together. Somebody else is in the game. But Boaz has more to say to the man with no name. He says, then Boaz said, on the day you buy the land from Naomi, you also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the dead man's widow, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property. I'm going to tell you that in the translation, they have added Ruth the Moabite. They have added a definition here that isn't in the original language. The thing that Boaz says to him is very obscure. Essentially, he says, on the day you get the land, you also get the dead man's widow. And so it would seem that perhaps he is talking about Naomi. And the man says, I'm out. I'm not going to do it. I can't do it. It's this interesting thing where Boaz is kind of keeping this information deliberately obscure. And so then at this, the guardian redeemer said, then I cannot redeem it because I might endanger my own estate. I think he might endanger his own life. There's another wife back there who's like, nah, you're not going to do it. You redeem it yourself. I cannot do it. Now, in earlier times in Israel, for the redemption and transfer of property to become final, one party took off his sandal and gave it to the other. This was the method of legalizing transactions in Israel. So I wish we would go back to that. But there aren't very many women who want to give up a shoe. It's not going to happen. So the guardian redeemer said to Boaz, buy it yourself. And he removed his sandal. So look how fast Mr. Nobody lets go of this land. He wants the land, but he does not want a relationship. He wants to own something, but he doesn't want to marry something. Remember how the author has obscured Mr. Nobody's name? Let's circle back to the law from Deuteronomy and make this make sense. You'll remember way back like 7 minutes ago when we read that passage from Deuteronomy, it first talked about the responsibility of the redeemer to take the role of husband to the widow. Listen to this. But if the man does not desire to take his brother's wife, then his brother's wife shall go up to the gate to the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to establish a name for his brother. Then the elders of his city shall summon him and speak to him. And if he persists and says, I do not desire to take her, then his brother's wife shall come to him in the sight of the elders and pull his sandal off his foot and spit in his face, and she shall declare, thus it is done to the man who does not build up his brother's house. In Israel, his name shall be called the house of him whose sandal is removed. He gets no name. If you're not willing to build your brother's house, if you're not willing to build your brother's name, there goes your name. You're going to be called the man with one shoe for the rest of your life. Is what's going to happen. And I just love how seriously the God of Israel takes redemption. He takes it seriously. If you're not willing to step into my work of redemption, your name is gone. You just don't have it. It's honestly really beautiful. So this is why the writer of this text won't dignify this guy with a name. So this is Boaz's big moment. I love this moment. Boaz is something here. He announces to the elders and all the people, today you are witnesses that I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon. Oh, their names didn't come up before. Those guys didn't come up in the last conversation. I have also acquired Ruth, the Moabite, Mahlon's widow, as my wife, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property so that his name will not disappear from among his family or from his hometown. Now Boaz is very clear about who he is going to marry. Oh yeah, it's Ruth. It's not Naomi. I'm actually going to marry Ruth. And it's wonderful. Boaz goes on to vow that he will perpetuate the name of the dead man. He also vows that his first son will preserve Elimelech's line. This is not legally required. Some of it is, but lots of it isn't. But at the core of Boaz's character seems to be a deep well of generosity. He's given gifts to Ruth and Naomi before, but this is the biggest of them all. He's given them a name. He's giving them a future. He's giving them the field, the whole field. In the following verses, the writers begin to wrap this up, and they bring together several intertwined themes. One is the empty to full theme that we talked about in week one of this. Naomi said, I went away full, and I came back empty. And all of Ruth is the process of her coming back empty and getting full. It's beautiful. But then the other theme is equally beautiful. It says this, "Then the elders and all the people at the gate said, 'We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, who together built the family of Israel. May you have standing in Ephrathah and be famous in Bethlehem. Though the offspring, through the offspring the Lord gives you by the young woman, may your family be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah.'" Remember Judah? He is the lion of the tribe of Judah. So Ruth, the foreign, marginalized, destitute widow, is now being compared to the matriarchs of Israel. This is a great reversal we did not see coming. Is she going to be famous in Bethlehem? I'm pretty sure. This is a huge comeback story. These guys say, "May you have standing and be famous in Bethlehem." Ruth and Boaz go on to have a baby. His name is Obed, who will eventually inherit Elimelech's land. He will also eventually have a baby himself, and the baby will be named Jesse, and Jesse will be the father of David, the man after God's own heart. The homeless widow, the least of the least, will give birth to the father of the greatest king in Israel. And Ruth will be one of four women mentioned in the genealogy of King Jesus. And her name will indeed be famous in Bethlehem. It's unbelievable. If you don't have goosebumps, I don't know what to do for you. I've done all I can do. Because this is a big deal, and it's more than just beautiful. It's more than just a fun story. It's more than what we've joked about throughout the weeks, a Hallmark movie. It's more than that. There are three big things that I have come to love in this story. And there are like lots and lots of things. There aren't just 3 points here. Study it, pull them out. What is God saying to you through it? But three that I want to highlight today as we close. The first thing is God is always at work in the story. Always. He's always at work. And often his work works through us. Philippians 1:6 says, "He who began a good work in you will be faithful to complete it." Why does Paul have to assure them that God will be faithful to complete the work he started? Because they're in a meanwhile season. They're not sure. That's the only reason he needs to confirm it, because somebody isn't sure. And I'm going to say today, probably somebody isn't sure that God is going to come through and complete what he's promised or the story that he's writing in you. But God is at work in your story. Naomi tells Ruth, Boaz won't rest until the matter is completed. Paul tells us God won't rest until the matter is completed. He is on it. He is writing your story, and it's beautiful. He is at work. He's always at work. Number two, today's obedience is tomorrow's harvest. God is always at work, and he invites us to partner with him. My husband planted tomatoes a little bit ago. He's the gardener, and I am not. And I'm like 3 days later, where are those tomatoes? Are there tomatoes? Can I have the tomatoes? He's like, it's like 40 degrees at night. These tomatoes are not growing until July. And I'm like, why is that? Because the planting and then the waiting and then the harvest. But today's planting is tomorrow's reaping. But we must have today. We must have the sowing. We must be willing to put the seed in the ground and trust God with it. Psalm 129, one of my favorites. And one of my least favorites, "Those who sow in tears will reap with shouts of joy. He who goes out weeping, bearing a trail of seed, will surely return with shouts of joy, carrying sheaves of grain." Can you picture this? The sower, it's just a little trail of grain, just dit, 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 sowing his grain, crying. Why is he weeping? It's probably all he has. He's putting it in the ground, burying it. Unless a seed falls and dies, it cannot live again. And so he's burying it through tears. And then a few months later, there he is, bringing armloads of harvest. I went to a church in Nairobi, and it was a really big church that met in a stadium. And at the end, they gave an altar call, and these people just started streaming forward. I don't know, maybe 75, 100 people start streaming forward. And the pastor calls out the small group leaders, and he calls them down, and he says, "Small group leaders, come receive your harvest. You have the harvest. You've been sowing, you've been sowing, you've been sowing, reaping." here we are reaping. It's beautiful. Being found, Ruth deciding to scavenge for food in the field of a stranger was sowing in tears. Being found and blessed by Boaz, harvest. Naomi deciding to walk back to Bethlehem was sowing in tears. The arrival of a baby who would carry on the name of Elimelech, harvest. You know, I obey. Obey today. Obey now. Drop the seed in the ground. Trust that the seeds you are sowing will bear fruit beyond what your eyes can see. I'm watching this happen in before church right now. I am watching it. I had a conversation with Pastor Randy the other day, and he said, what is God saying to you right now? And I said, God is saying, I can see shoots everywhere from the seeds that we've been planting. 23 people baptized last Sunday, and I heard their stories of redemption. People birthed into the kingdom. It's shoots happening, harvest happening. There's freedom and flourishing happening, miraculous stories. Watching transformation begin to take place in the lives at every spot on the journey of knowing Jesus. Seeing marriages healed in reunion. Seeing people fall in love with the Word of God in Bible studies and groups. Celebrate Recovery meets every Thursday night, and they share together stories of heartache and sorrow, and they sow those stories with tears, and they are reaping transformation and freedom. That's what's happening inside the walls of God's garden here. There is a harvest, and we need to be able to see it. We can get our eyes on every other thing and just hold our seed carefully, closely to ourselves. But what he's saying is plant the seed. What if I pay for a scholarship and that kid ends up being a little brat? What if it doesn't work? What if it doesn't show fruit? At least you've obeyed. You've sown the seed. God will not be in debt to you, friend. Seeds of tears are springing up here into a harvest of beauty, armloads of beauty. And number three is just so simple. It's just such a simple point. That's why these guys are here, because they're gonna carry it home. Our Redeemer loves us. He loves us. It's almost remedial, but it's the most advanced concept, I think. Our Redeemer loves us. He is not reluctantly rescuing us. He is driven by his heart that no one be lost. 1 John 3:16, this is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers and sisters. He redeems us, and we ought to act as redemptive agents inside his world. The other John 3:16, maybe you've heard of it. For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only son, for God so judged the world, for God so was annoyed at the world, for God so wanted to fix the world, for God so loved us. He loves us. Our Redeemer lives and he loves us. We started this series talking about metanoia. It means to turn around and go the other way because you've had a change of heart or a change of mind. And the story of Ruth shows miraculous metanoia on nearly every page. Great reversals. It can only be described as a comeback story. And that's really all any of us are. That's all we are. We didn't start at the top and then need him. We are a comeback story. Paul says, you were dead. Not you were sick. You were dead. And he came and he raised you to new life because he loves you. Great reversals. We are bought with a great price, and we turn toward our Redeemer, and we see him loving us, and then we love him. We run to him and throw ourselves into his arms. We are Ruth. We are the least of the least and still the most loved. This is not just an ancient love story. This is our love story. That's the gotcha, the plot twist. This is our love story. Our Redeemer lives, and he will stand on the earth, and he will step into our story, the story he has always been writing in us.
The sun, where to stand in the morning. Who told the ocean you can only come this far? And who showed the moon where to hide till evening? Whose words alone can catch a falling star? Well, I know my Redeemer lives, and I know my Redeemer.
Up, I would love for you to just picture yourself in whatever field God has you. You are the least and yet the most loved. And God is meeting you there with his presence and with his provision. He has not left you or forsaken you in the meantime. He is at work in the meanwhile. Holy Spirit, go to each heart that feels the absence of something, a person, a job, a relationship, a child. God, would you go to that space and bring redemptive love, redeeming love? Jesus, this space is sacred, and we recognize your presence here, and we say thank you for being with us. We receive from you healing and hope and freedom that will lead to flourishing as we live joyfully in the field you've called us to. We love and worship you. In your name we pray.